Good afternoon, and welcome to Midday. I'm Carla Hayden, filling in for Tom Hall today. And I've been around books and libraries a long time. I was the 14th Librarian of Congress, a job that ended rather abruptly last May.
Right now, critics of the president are accusing his administration of censorship after the White House fired the Librarian of Congress.
But before that, I was fortunate enough to be the CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library System right here in Baltimore for more than two decades. And before that, though, in the late 80s, then Mayor Kurt Schmoke dubbed Baltimore the city that reads. Here he is featured in an ad campaign promoting that new tagline.
Hey, Daddy, why'd you change the benches?
To let people know we're making Baltimore the city that reads.
Even on benches?
On benches, on city trucks, everywhere. This is the new symbol of Baltimore. What do you think? Kathy, Baltimore, the city that reads.
a librarian's dream. And so, but fast forward to today, the age of screen time and endless scrolling, and yet there are clear signs in Baltimore that Baltimore is reading. Literacy rates for the school children continue to improve and close the gaps on scores in other parts of the state. City students' proficiency gained 3.5 percentage points between the school year starting in 2023 and the school year starting in 2024. And this was the ninth consecutive year of gains. And another librarian's favorite, there are now more holders of library cards than ever before. And so on today's show, as Black History Month comes to an end, we're having a conversation about books, libraries, and Baltimore's connection to the written word. And to start us off, our first guest today is Dr. Martha Jones. She's an award-winning writer and historian and a professor at the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Jones, welcome to the program. It's great to have you here. I've been a fan of yours for years.
It's an honor to be here, Dr. Hayden. Thank you.
And I've been looking forward to this. I even have your books. And some people, though, have poked fun at the city that reads over the years. And do you think that Baltimore lives up to that tagline?
One of the things I love to do with visitors to Baltimore is to take them on a small tour of our independent bookstores. You know, I think there are many, many cities and towns in this country where residents lament the disappearance of the independent bookstore, you know, the takeover of the big box store is the only place where folks can go to perhaps find a little literature. But here, it's an embarrassment of riches in this city, and it continues to grow and change. And for me, as a writer, as a teacher, as a Baltimorean, it's extraordinarily exciting. Last week, I was at one of our bookstores with a Mary Helen Washington, who has a new biography of Paul Marshall. And we got to have a live conversation with a room full of folks who had come out on a cold winter's night for a warm conversation. And that's really, I think, one of the cores of our well-deserved reputation. It's our independent booksellers.
So it really is a city of readers, that literary tradition. And you've mentioned the difference from other cities and places that you've been. Why do you think Baltimore has that?
You know, I first started coming here now, it's 25 years ago, as a researcher. And I would be, after my day in the archives, I would go take myself to dinner. I'd sit at a local bar, and inevitably you strike up a conversation. And folks would ask me, so what brings you to Baltimore? And I'd say, I'm writing a book. And before you know it, you were deep in a conversation, not only about the book itself, but about the history of the city, which was my subject matter, and the exchange of information, because folks wanted to make sure that when you were done, they got a copy of that book that you were working on. And so I think it's deep in the fabric of this city. The way in which books are, as they are for so many people, a gateway to knowledge. But you find that, yes, in our bookstores and, of course, in our great libraries. But I'm here to say you can also find it at the local bar, the local cafe. The person next to you will be really happy to talk about what they're reading.
And what do you think is behind that, though, that interest in reading now with all of the technology we have and people scrolling and doing all this, but they still want to read?
I think that in part, people have deep questions, right? Facing deep puzzles about who we are, how we got here. Now, I'm a historian, so I'm going to lean in on that. But it's remarkable to me how when a historical question sort of surfaces or is underneath the issue of the day, the way in which folks are eager, not only for the soundbite, if you will, right? Not only for the clip, but really eager to discover for themselves. And I think there's something about our independence and I think a necessity, if I could say, in a city about which stories are told, right? That we, I think, in Baltimore are deeply committed and feel the urgency of writing our own stories. And in order to do that and to tell our own stories, and in order to do that, I think reading is essential.
Well, it's striking, the increase in illiteracy rates. However, there is that national data that's showing that younger Americans are spending less time with books. How do you think we approach that and getting them interested?
One of my experiences, and I have the privilege here from time to time to spend time in our K-12 schools with young people. And inevitably, what I come away with is if you write it, they will come, which is to say, certainly as a professor and an academic historian, I could spend my professional life writing for other historians, writing for scholars, writing for, I don't know, the Supreme Court or for Congress. I could be writing in that direction. But I think part of our mission might be, right, to be listening to young people and asking what it is that they need to know and writing to them. So I wrote a book in 2018 called Birthright Citizens, which was about early Black politics in Baltimore City and the role that Black Americans here played in conceiving of and advocating for this idea of birthright citizenship. Well, when I taught that book with high schoolers, what they said to me was, Dr. Jones, why did you keep this from us for so long? They weren't saying how many pages and what's the assignment. They were saying, this is what part of what we've been waiting to read. And so I think we need to be listening to young people and understanding better what it is that they think they need to know and writing for them.
Has there been an uptick in a request for that book about birthright
citizenship? Oh, gosh, yes.
My goodness.
I say, in some sense, tragically so, that the issue, as we know, is going to be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court on April 1st. And just yesterday, I, along with my colleague Kate Mazur, submitted our historian's brief in support of immigrant Americans and their rightful claims to being birthright citizens. But unfortunately, the book has really had discovered a wide readership as people have come to the question and want deep understanding.
And it's written to be consumed by younger people.
Well, I'm going to say this, Dr. Hayden, not so much. I wish that were true, so I don't want to mislead your audience, but enough so, right? And it's filled with characters and stories and narratives about on-the-ground struggles around citizenship and belonging in early America, and I think this has helped readers find their way into some of the more academic and law-bound questions.
That brings me to another aspect of encouraging young people and people in general to read. Many people turn to audiobooks, and I have been asked, and I think you probably have been asked too, is that really reading when you listen to a book?
I think it has to be in 2026. I don't see how we get away from it. You know, I published a book last year, you know, a memoir called The Trouble of Color. And two things happened. But one was that for the first time, I was asked to narrate the book myself. And this was meaningful for readers who were reading a very personal narrative to hear my voice, actually my expressions, my emotions coming through. It's a kind of reading. I say yes. And to me, anything that gets folks closer to the book has to be a good thing. I hope it is. I want to know what you think, actually.
Well, do you think anything is lost?
Well, I think that it's a challenge. I take it as a challenge to us as writers. In other words, and someone who listens to an audiobook doesn't see our illustrations, doesn't see our charts and graphs. And so we can become, I think, more cognizant of that, more conscious of that, and write toward that with the, listen, people are reading while they're on their way to work, while they're making dinner, right? While they're bathing the kids. People are multitasking many times over. And I don't want to discourage that. But as a writer, I want to keep them in mind, too, because they may never see the beautiful illustrations that I've included in the book. So I need to put those into words.
So you're writing in a different way?
Absolutely.
With that in mind,
absolutely.
That some people will be listening to the book and some people will be actually holding the book and looking at the illustrations.
Yeah, and I don't think one, you know, it precludes the other. You meet enough readers who will tell you, I listened, then I bought the book, or I bought the book and then I listened. So aren't we in a time of extraordinary change and transition where we're inventing what reading is or reinventing what reading is? But when I meet those folks who then show up at the library when you come to talk about the book, or show up in the bookshop when you come to talk about the book, they are as engaged and as absorbed, right, in the narrative, but in the word, as the person who held the object.
Well, I can't let us go by without realizing that we're at the end of Black History Month. And you are an expert in Black history and looking at history in its entirety, also hard history. So do you have some recommendations?
I certainly do.
For what people could read.
I'll add to your the auspiciousness of this moment, which is that we're also approaching the 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, which we will celebrate in July. And so I think the convergence of our own political moment, coupled with always the poignancy of Black History Month and this important anniversary for the United States, brought me back to a book that I had read years ago, which was Danielle Allen's Our Constitution. Now, the Constitution as a historical matter, the Declaration, like the Constitution, right, is a complicated historical matter. But part of what Danielle Allen urges us to do first is to read the Declaration, right? It's under 2,000 words. We should all take time to read it. But she offers it as a text, a political philosophy about equality and about freedom. And really urges that that text, those ideas belong to all of us, right? They may be contested. They certainly are in this moment, as they have always been in our history. And they will continue to be provocative, controversial, but central questions for this country. And I love that she urges us to come back and set aside, if you will, figures like Thomas Jefferson, who had such an important hand in this document, to remind us that here in 2026 is a document that belongs and a set of ideas that belong to all of us. So Danielle Allen's Our Declaration is a book I really recommend.
And that's interesting that you're recommending that for Black history.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Because part of what Allen says, of course, is that for Black Americans, these two notions, freedom on the one hand, but equality on the other, are equally potent. And our objective, I think, in her view, is to wrestle with and do better, if not resolve, the tensions, right, that arise when, on the one hand, we value independence and freedom, and on the other hand, we value equality. I hope that rings familiar to Americans in 2026. It certainly was at the core of the American experiment in 1776.
Danielle Allen.
Yes.
Wonderful that you would bring that as the thing we should all read. Dr. Martha Jones is an author and a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University, where she's also a professor at the SNF Agora Institute. And her most recent book is The Trouble of Color, an American Family Memoir. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Jones.
Thank you, Dr. Hayden.
And we are going to continue coming up next. The Enoch Pratt Free Library has been seeing a lot more people looking for books lately, and we'll talk to President and CEO Chad Hilton about that and meeting the needs of young visitors. It's midday. I'm Carla Hayden. Stay with us.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Carla Hayden. Coming up on Monday's show, journalist Jane Miller takes over the host chair to speak with reporters covering the Maryland State House as the General Assembly enters the second half of the session. Plus, Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal on Baltimore's struggling downtown. That's on Monday's show. Today, we're talking about Baltimore's growing love of literature. With so many Americans worrying about screen time, this may surprise some people. There are now more Enoch Pratt Free Library cardholders in Baltimore than ever before, and use of the library's collection increased by nearly 9% from 2024 to 2025. Chad Hilton took over as president and CEO of Enoch Pratt Free Libraries in the fall of 2024. And some people might know that I had the honor of being in Chad's position and saw an increase, but this is phenomenal. So welcome back to Midday, Chad.
Thank you so much for having me. It is truly an honor.
Well, that statistic is pretty incredible. In just 1 year, and I know you had a lot to do with this, there was a 9% increase in the number of library materials checked out, and that includes ebooks, I know. And that's becoming a trend for the Enoch Pratt Free Library. So let's talk about that, because what do you think caused this rise in circulation this past year, 1 year?
Well, I would say that we have put a lot of emphasis in our ebooks. We have a lot of direct access to the Baltimore Banner, the Baltimore Sun, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. And having those editions has really led to a lot of e-usage, and it's increased. And when we look at our collections are becoming more reflective of the communities that we serve. And we have an amazing staff that makes people feel like they are welcome. And people will come back continuously because of that.
You mentioned newspaper subscriptions, because that's certainly a difference.
Yes, we have tons of free access to newspaper subscriptions so that people will be able to have the information and not have to go through paywalls. So it's a really incredible thing that we've been doing recently.
Now, that's incredible, because I know that's something new, and it prohibits so many people from getting access to information, and especially in newspapers with so much news going on.
Yes. Definitely.
So you have that, you have the ebooks. What about multimedia?
So we have a lot of multimedia. One of the very interesting things now is people are back into vinyl. I never let go of mine. I've always been a music person. But you can come check out vinyl, check out DVDs, Blu-rays, check out video games. We have video games in our teen section. So we have tons of multimedia that people are able to access. And it's been really exciting to see people come back and use that physical medium that might not have been used as much in the past.
And I have a confession to make. I got rid of my vinyl and I think about it now. And so I'm sure that you have a lot of people who did the same thing.
Yes.
And would like that experience again. And so you have one of the largest collections from what I understand.
We do. We have a very large collection. We've been floating around ideas of having mocktails with me and us talking about records. So that might be something that comes down in the future.
And I know, and I have to probe you about this a little bit, that you are a music lover and a Prince fan.
That
and
I am.
You have something you were telling me about, because I like Prince too.
Yes. So Steve Park, who is one of Prince's former artistic directors from 1990 to 2001, is coming out with a book. And the title of that book is Prince Black, White, Color. And he will be releasing that book, We Are the First Stop, on his world tour on May 5th. There might be some special guests that come along with that. We haven't solidified that piece yet. But Steve is an incredible, incredible photographer, incredible artist. If anybody's familiar with the Graffiti Bridge album cover, that he designed that album cover. He's worked with so many people, Sheila E., many people in Prince world, and he is from here.
He's from Maryland.
He grew up in Baltimore.
In Baltimore, specifically.
He grew up in Baltimore, and I'm not going to tell his story because
He's
going to tell it. But yes, he grew up in Baltimore, and he got his start here.
My goodness, I bet he used the Pratt Library too.
Oh yes, he did.
He is going to mention that because. That statistic about the checkouts, the programs are also rising. And this type of program, I'm sure, is going to really bring in so many people. But you've had so many other programs recently.
Yes. We have an amazing group of people that come up with all sorts of program ideas. And it was really interesting. We do so many amazing programs that whenever I was reporting out once about the programs that we were doing, we had completely forgotten that we had had a Supreme Court justice do a program.
Really?
It was just completely forgotten. It's like, oh my gosh, like this would have been like...
The headline.
This would be the headline everywhere, but this is just what...
Another person coming
right.
to the Pratt Library in Baltimore.
But our team, it's a Wednesday for... The team that we have. They are
Ketanji Brown Jackson, and then you have Nora O'Donnell, and then
yes.
you have so many notable authors.
So many people that come. Jada Pinkett Smith, Eve, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, like all of these people come, and it's because of the love that they have for the library, the love for what we do and what we stand for. And we have an incredible team that always pulls this off and really makes it seem effortless. And it's just incredible to work with a group of people who really put so much into what they do for, you know, the people of this community.
And so, Chad, you've been here a year, but how did you get to the Enoch Pratt Free Library?
So how I got to the Enoch Pratt Free Library is very interesting. I never... got into libraries because it was my dream. It wasn't something that I ever even thought of. I was at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill as an undergrad, and I had the bright idea that I didn't need school, and I quit. And my mother and father told me that if I ever quit, I was on my own. And I didn't believe them, but they meant it. And I was on couches for a good 7 years, chronically underemployed. It was a humongous struggle. And I worked three jobs. I worked at the homeless shelter, the bike shop, and I worked at a restaurant as a prep cook. And I was really, really trying to get everything in my life back together. And a buddy of mine had a job at the UNC Chapel Hill Library. And he was like, hey, I can get you this job driving a golf cart, delivering books to all the satellite campuses. And he was hoping that somehow that would help me get back into school as well. And I got the job and I ran into a former dean. And he asked me had I graduated because he was surprised I was on campus. I told him no. He asked me to come back to his office that Monday to just have a conversation with him. And when I went to that office, he had already registered me for the classes that I needed to graduate. And at that point, something clicked in my head that here's this person that has nothing to gain from helping me other than seeing me be successful. And it changed my life from that day forward. And I just worked my way up through libraries, and I saw libraries as the way to help people like he had helped me. And that's pretty much how I got here.
You mentioned, of course, the staff, but also the people of the city love this library. And that's part of what we both have worked, for instance, in other cities. And we note, though, that it's different here in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to hear you talk about your experiences, because I remember people when I first arrived here, everyone had a Pratt Library story.
Yes.
From all walks of life.
So true. So true. And it's really interesting. I was in Whole Foods, I want to say like a week ago, and a person that worked there stopped me and was like, oh, wow, you're the president of the Pratt Library. And you know, I didn't want him to see like the tubs of ice cream that I was getting.
That is the danger.
but it was just incredible. It's like, wow, like it really means something to the people here. And I tell people all of the time, like everywhere that I've been, people talk about how much they love the library, but here people show it. And it's like one of my favorite James Brown songs, saying it and doing it, you know, like
they do it.
They do it. And it's such an incredible thing, and it's such an amazing thing to really be a part of.
And so that love of the Pratt Library really makes you think about, as you're working with the library staff, what can we do to make sure that generations to come will have Pratt Library stories? And I know that you've been working with the teen centers and all of these things to get young people involved.
Yes. Like when I was growing up, the library wasn't a place that I ever really went to, because I never felt like it was something that spoke to me. And I feel it's important to bring people in to these spaces so that they can have experiences that they didn't think that they could have. And one of those was our House of Mellow, working with Carmelo Anthony. Several people came up to me and they were just amazed that libraries did things like this, and they had never even been in the library. And it's like, oh, so I see that you all do this. This speaks to me. This speaks to the community. And we have artwork of some of the local heroes in our new Johnson Square location. That brings people in to see the people of their community being highlighted and honored and celebrated in their spaces. And that's something that I think that we need to do more of, and something that is part of my plan to really celebrate the heroes that come out of Baltimore.
Now, you mentioned that new branch, and there have been a number of construction and reconstruction projects that are underway. And I know the Brooklyn branch just reopened.
Yes, it did.
And that really needed quite a bit. I remember that one. But you really see that as so important. And with the budgets tightening up, the library is part of the infrastructure, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And the city and the state have been very supportive. And I would like to thank you, and I would like to thank my other predecessors for everything that they did to get the ball rolling with these projects. Because I always say, like, I just saw the end of it. But the work that came to get all of this done was done before me by my predecessors, and I'm greatly appreciative.
It takes a lot to finish it, too. Trust me.
It does. It does. It does.
You don't just do that.
Thank you.
And these investments in physical structures, you mentioned the artwork. What do you see that meaning to those communities, to see themselves reflected in
Well, to me, I think one of the most important things is whenever you look at the composition of the city and you look at the leadership of the city, a lot of times whenever you walk into our libraries, that's not really represented as much. And, you know, having something that kids can look up to and kids can be inspired to be, and seeing that, you know, we have a black mayor, we have a black governor, and you can easily do this yourself. Like, I try to tell kids all the time that you have the ability to do whatever it is that you want to do. You just have to put in the effort. And once you are able to see that someone like you and someone that looks like you has been able to do these types of things, then it will get you believing and understanding that you can do those types of things. So really focused on that is something that we're going to move into in the next year.
And the House of Mellow was able to attract young people who didn't think that the library had anything for them.
Correct. And to be able to see, you know, Carmelo's story is it's an incredible story. I mean, you know, because the thing about Carmelo is, I hate when people say, like, made it out, because I would say that Carmelo made it out. Like, because Carmelo actually never left. He's here, like, every other weekend. Carmelo is in Baltimore. He is always here. And that's one of the things that really impressed me about him, the fact of the matter that he really does come to the community that he grew up in, and he gives back to that community. And there's so many people here that do that, and I want to highlight those individuals.
And he wanted to tie it to the Pratt Library, because he used the Pratt Library.
Yes, he used the Pratt Library.
And that's just so important for them to hear. In fact, later in the show, we're going to talk to a young person who has created a map of Baltimore's literary scene. And I'm pretty excited about
that. Oh, that's cool.
Because the public library is important landmarks for these young students. But how do you, and you're part of this effort, compete with all the options they have, the machines and the entertainment that's really in their hands? How do we...
You know,
it's
interesting because I think that for me personally, I don't take the approach of competing, because I feel like if I compete, I'm not going to win, because there's so many things to distract you. There's so many things to distract you. But what I've experienced is that it all comes back around at some point. I mean, kids use cassettes again. And cassettes are a thing. Like, cassettes are worth a lot of money now. And people think it's cool to have a book rather than to have their iPad or their Kindle. Like, people want to have that physical book. And it just all cycles. And if you just wait and if you're patient, they will always come back around to you. And I think that's the approach that I've always taken, because, you know, I know the music that I listen to is cool. They'll end up listening to it at some point.
You are a music lover. You definitely are a music lover, but that's one way to get them involved is through music and lyrics. And they've always talked about how when you think about rap or other things, that's really poetry.
Yes.
And that you put that in motion. So what do you have coming up besides the prints, which I'll definitely be there?
Oh, we have a few things coming up. One of the bigger things that we're working on is... we are about to create a program highlighting the leadership of Black Maryland. So we're going to highlight government officials that have, you know, our governor, our mayor, highlighting those and highlighting officials from Reconstruction up and highlighting Black leaders in Maryland. So we're working on that.
And other exhibits. Well, I have to ask you, though, about book recommendations. You are a librarian, and even though you're music and everything but that, because we're in the final days of Black History Month.
Okay.
So what are there any titles or authors or books, and you could tell us a little bit about it that you'd recommend?
Okay, so I'm going to go the music route.
Good.
Miles, the autobiography by Miles Davis and Quincy Troup.
That's a good one.
It's an amazing book. You learn about Miles. Some of the stories are kind of out there, but I mean, Miles Davis is one of the most influential musicians, period. Him, Duke Ellington, Music Is My Mistress by Duke Ellington, learning the story of, Beyond Category, as they used to call Duke Ellington, checking that book out. The book that I read recently, Carmelo's book with Dee Watkins.
And all of these books, Chad, really take you into Black history. So you get into it through music, but the experiences of those musicians highlight Black history.
Yes, because it's really interesting whenever you start to look at music, especially jazz music and the civil rights movement. There was a little bit of a backlash in the late 50s because white musicians were kind of taking the music of Black Americans and selling it off as their own. So how can you make music that they can't take? And that's when you start to move into the jazz avant-garde and Black Power music and things of that nature. So it teaches you the history of Black Americans as being innovators, but having those innovations sort of taken. And that's a bit of a story that exists in our history, sadly.
But it's also a way to make Black history relatable to especially a generation that is more audio or more music oriented and things like that. So,
definitely.
And I know you're planning for Black History Month next year.
Oh, yes, yes. I'm trying to figure out, I want to do some big things. So what I did when I was in Minnesota was we turned, every single day we highlighted an African-American leader on our webpage, and we told their story, and we did that for every single day for Black leadership. And thinking sort of things along that line, but really trying to just highlight this city and all of the amazing people that have come from this city that sometimes people forget came from here. You know, Frederick Douglass, Cab Calloway.
Oh, Cab Calloway, that's your music again.
UB Blake, like all of these people that have just come from, Billie Holiday. And sadly, sadly that has been lost. And the Librarian of Congress came from here too.
All right.
We need to.
I still live here.
We need to highlight that.
That's so wonderful because you have that large African American collection.
Yes.
Eddie and Sylvia Brown collection.
Yes.
This room, people can go in and access such a wealth in the new Dwayne Wickham collection.
Yes.
And journalism. So there's so many things of Black history. So we are excited that you're here, Chad.
Thank you.
And taking the Pratt Library and the people of the area forward in this time.
Well, thank you so much.
Chad Hilton, President and CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. And that's the word, too. Free.
Free. Yes, free.
So thank you for joining us,
Chad. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Up next, a tour. Baltimore's young readers and writers map the city's rich literary scene. Whitney Birenbaum of Charm Lit Magazine and Carmen Rogers, a member of their student editorial board, will join us after this quick break. I'm Carla Hayden, filling in for Tom Hall today here on Midday. Stay with us. Carla Hayden, filling in for Tom Hall here on Midday. When we talk about Baltimore's rich literary scene, we often do so from the eyes of its more famous literary giants, like Edgar Allan Poe or H.L. Mencken. But what does Baltimore literature look like from the eyes of its next generation of writers? Well, now, a group of Baltimore students have put together an illustrated map, Baltimore's literary scene through their eyes. And the map's release was made to coincide with the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Conference and Book Fair starting on March the 4th. And we don't usually highlight conferences, but this is different. 10,000 writers and lovers of the written word will be here in Baltimore. Whitney Birnbaum is executive director of Charm Literary Magazine, and Cameron Rogers is a proud senior at Baltimore City College High School and a member of Charm Lit Student Editorial Board. And they're joining me here in Studio A. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This map is wonderful. And if you could just describe, Whitney, to start out, what is on the map? We have it here. It's gorgeous.
So Charm's whole mission is to support young people as they develop as writers and create opportunities to amplify their voices through publication. The Baltimore Youth Literary Map is an illustrated guide that documents the spaces across the city that inspire young people to read, write, and tell their stories. The map is also an invitation to visitors and locals alike to engage with Baltimore's vibrant literary scene, which our young people are such a vital part of. And in fact, the map is a collaboration between several youth writing organizations, Writers in Baltimore Schools, Do More, and Wide Angle Youth Media. And on the map are just places that our students have selected that they view as literary, that give them inspiration.
And I noticed that, and Cameron, the work that went into this, you have all kinds of cool things, cafes and bakeries and libraries and parks. What went into this?
So we initially started off by brainstorming places that we've experienced as youth. Some of the main places include Greedy Reads. I interned there. There was also Patterson Park, the Enoch Pratt Library, and many other bookstores and libraries that that resonated with us as writers and as readers.
And the cafes and the bakeries, how did that get in there? I know you guys like to eat, right?
Yes, yes. So the cafes and bakeries, a lot of people go there to work, obviously, but also, you know, to grab a little snack. So it's a good mixture between, you know, you wanting to, you know, to work and write and be in a creative space, but also, you know, grab a little snack. One of my favorite places is Oven Bird Bakery. I go there to do some schoolwork sometimes when I'm writing important papers.
And you have a piece in the book, too. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Cameron, I'd be interested in you thinking about all of these people coming, the literary types coming for that. What do you hope that those out-of-towners are going to think about Baltimore as a reading place?
I want them to be reminded that Baltimore isn't like The Wire. That's a big thing when people come here. They say it's similar to that television show that people watch, but it's not. It's a city of people of youth and people who are creative. You know, people don't see Baltimore as a creative space, and they definitely don't see youth as creative people, because people don't come to youth to ask for their ideas in the first place. So I definitely think that when people come here, I want them to be reminded that it's not just, you know, the popular authors that they see, like B.K. Borison or Laura Lippman. It's young people like me and other students in Baltimore City Public Schools as well.
Whitney, what do you think?
Well, the act of writing and reflecting is such a meaningful process, but what I see every day with our students at Charm is taking it to the next level, this vulnerable and courageous act of publishing and sharing their work. And I hope people see that. I hope that people take time to explore the places on the map, read the students' poems and many memoirs about many of the places,
And then this week, whether you're going to the AWP conference or you just live in Baltimore and want to plug in, there's hundreds of events happening in junction with this conference at local bookstores, readings, parties, so many things. And like Carla Dupre, who leads Baltimore's amazing City Lit, said at our map reveal party, you know, we want people to know that Baltimore is the city that reads, but it's also the city that writes.
And the map, how can people get copies of this wonderful map?
We're really grateful that the Pratt Library has stocked the map at all locations. We have a team of volunteers led by Kate Reed Petty, an author who has partnered with us in conceptualizing this project to get the map into all the independent bookstores.
Well, I'm Carla Hayden, and you're listening to Midday here on WYPR, and I'm speaking with Whitney Birnbaum, Executive Director of Charm Literary Magazine, and Cameron Rogers, a proud senior at Baltimore City College High School, and a member of the Charm Lit Student Editorial Board, and also an author who is included in this wonderful 10-year anthology. Tell us about this, because it's just also all of the artwork and everything. I hope people get a chance to see this.
So we always start our anthologies off by brainstorming ideas. We already knew that we wanted to do a 10-year rewind of all the important works that students did throughout the entire 10-year span of Charm. So us as members of the editorial board, we have favorite pieces. We obviously read a lot of the anthologies, so we took some of our favorite pieces and we put it all together, and that's why we have like this scrapbook look on our cover, because it's like a scrapbook. It's a mixture of so many different points and places in time for Charm. So they all come together in this one single book, and I think that's really important.
And the students designed it, because the design of the book is just amazing.
Yes, we helped design the book. We also have the colorful side, you know, to section off the different the anthologies that we have. We have how many anthologies do we have, Ms. Whitney?
So we're really proud that over the past 10 years we've published 1,200 students in 30 publications, all youth-led and youth-centered. And just a note about this publication, Rewind, and the map, we partner with Yifan Luo, a local illustrator who's also our lead designer, so our students can learn those things as well.
Well, Whitney Birnbaum is Executive Director of Charm Literary Magazine, and Cameron Rogers, senior at Baltimore City High School and a member of the Charm Lit Student Editorial Board. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been wonderful.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for us today. Coming up on Monday, a roundup of state races and the General Assembly with veteran journalist Jane Miller. And Fresh Air is up next. I'm Carla Hayden, live from Studio A here at WYPR on Midday. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR.